Anyone like to make any points? Any questions? Bill, you had your hand raised, so yep, far away.
It's very interesting. What Colin Skett said, but just I'm just wondering: is our position one of definite opposition to Labour vouchers, or a preferring a pragmatic approach towards them, which is that they are not, as the SLP would have, absolutely essential for socialism. But for instance, if say in the early period we found that the free rider problem was greater than we expect it should be, or found that the coordination of Labour was more difficult than we would expect, but we could fall back on it as something we could use as part of, not necessarily, not of, as you say, exchanging of equivalents, but just as a monitoring tool that could help people, you know, help maintain some elements of Labour self-discipline. And it has certain advantages compared to some alternatives, such as rationing, direct rationing, like during the Second World War, because that does require essential strategic authority, whereas Labour vouchers, the productive units can issue their own and use their own, and the like. And also, there is an element of, compared to other alternatives, which would be things like during the Spanish Civil War, people producing their union card to get free services, like on the buses and that, which is, it's just Labour type vouchers by another route. You turn up and done your shift. But Labour type vouchers has one slight benefit, I suppose, which is you don't rely on an equalisation of Labour time, of the working week. People can work varying amounts of the week based on their ability, although they would only get some reward back for that. But I think that it's a pragmatic approach, but it's not an essential. But if we find it is necessary, I don't think we would have to balk at using it.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with what you said. I think we don't have a policy of outright rejection, more of a pragmatic position that it probably wouldn't be necessary. And I think perhaps a slightly more liberatory sort of sense of what that revolution will be than people that advocate Labour vouchers. But, I mean, there's been many opinions on Labour vouchers as members of the Socialist Party, so, you know.
Danny?
Oh, I disagree. I see a socialist revolution coming about by the end of alienation. You know, we'll discover a common identity. And what I think will fire us up is that when we've got a common identity, we'll be looking around the world, all of our fellow humans, members of our human family, we all share the same ancestors. And what the first thing we'd have to do after the socialist revolution, we'd have been making plans up to the point of the revolution, is to make sure that every member of our world community can be up on their feet, out of poverty, taking a full part in the social life of society as quickly as possible. And that's going to motivate people, not how much they can take from the common store. I mean, we won't be as in capitalism, and we'll have a change of psychology. We won't be in capitalism judging ourselves by, you know, the more we can take, the more we have, you know, the more we can exclusively hold and deny others access to. We'll be looking at ourselves and assessing ourselves on, you know, what we bring, what we share, what we pass on. So I think the trade of vouchers just won't enter into a revolution, because there are far too many things to be getting on with than worrying about, you know, how much we're going to consume and making sure we're keeping score on everybody else.
I think, I mean, that has been the sort of majority view in the socialist side, I think.
Could you stand up with you?
Yeah. I think your position, Danny, probably is more the majority position has been in the Socialist Party over the years than perhaps the idea put forth by Bill. But
he's a maverick.
But I mean, it would be a nice problem to have, wouldn't it?
Well,
what I mean, I envisage exactly the same as you. That why would you, having achieved socialism with all that would entail, go back to going back to work the next day? If you didn't want to go back to work, you wouldn't go back to bloody work, would you? I mean, it's as simple as that. You'd go and do something else.
And especially like whatever work you were doing, it's socially creative, and you'd be doing it in the company of fellow volunteers, and it would be just so rewarding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in the event of shortage, it's there. But yeah, historically, we've always militated against it. We've always argued against the fact of the sort of outlook that a return to exchange would be necessary at all.
Any other points? Stephen?
Yeah. Yeah, the point's doing. Shane, when you've got industry concentrating in certain parts of the world, why would the Chinese want to give us all their iPhones and iPads? What would we. If we could do exchange, they wouldn't. Why would they want to exchange them rather than just give them to us?
Why would they want to exchange them?
Yeah, well they. But if the concentration of certain commodities are in certain parts of the world, so why would the Chinese be happy to give up all their iPods and perhaps get nothing in return for them?
I've no idea. The fact is that if you ever got to that point, I mean, you know, majority of people in China would be in the same position we were of wanting to shift, you know, use values around the world. If people didn't want to sit in factories and make iPods, they wouldn't make them. You know, simple as that. It's not just going to be a case of what do we do with the goods as we currently produce them. It's going to be a question of what do we produce. It would utterly change. It's actually making production an end in itself, as Marx put it. So it's not just a case of deciding how we distribute what currently exists. It's a case of how we change production. So the situation wouldn't arise in the way that you put it, I don't think.
I asked the question because it's what people ask me.
That's the answer I've given.
Effectively, China wouldn't be Chinese anymore. They would be human like the rest of us.
Come on, yeah.
And they'd be entitled to live anywhere else in the world like the rest of us.
If I could use sort of chair's privilege to chip in with a point myself while anyone else thinking of other points and questions. You briefly mentioned let schemes.
Yep.
And I'm a bit rusty on those. They're sort of not quite as fashionable as they were maybe 20 years ago, 20, 30 years ago. I think let schemes, if I remember rightly, it would be a case of, I don't know, I mow your lawn and you cut my hair or something in return. Yeah. But, you know, they're still going on. I think there are still a few hundred let schemes in Britain. And I was just wondering what your views are on let schemes. Are they the same as Labour vouchers? Could they sort of encourage people to think in a more socialistic way, or are they a bit of a sort of a cul-de-sac?
In and of themselves, I mean, you've got schemes that were launched in order that unemployed people, you know, an unemployed painter could go and paint someone's house and in return receive, I don't know, whatever, you know, his garden done or whatever. And as such, it's a perfectly decent way of going along. The sort of criticism of let schemes, where there was more ambition put behind it, such that could eventually become so established that it would start to supplant the regular capitalist economy, and I think is, you know, basically unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And obviously it works on the you know, basically individual labour, not you know, concerns, but, you know, a lot of things are produced with lots of labour all in one place, so cooperative labour of various types. So I just think it's completely impractical that to extend it other than beyond a quite a local scheme involving people who've got time on their hands.
Not sure who got their hands up first.
It's almost what you've just been saying, Mike.
Yeah, go ahead, Jo.
Back to the let schemes. I actually saw this happening in London, Clapham, and I have to say it was very middle class. It was a certain set of people who, I believe, had tokens or some sort of something they had to own.
Right.
And be owned, you know, because I heard the woman saying I was doing cleaning there at the time. She was very good to me, no problem. But I saw this going on, looking after children, as families or neighbours usually did. They would be doing it like that, or they would take their children somewhere else, or, like you said, use a van or go paint someone's house. But I think there was some sort of token involved.
Yeah.
Not all let schemes, I understand, are the same, but this one, you had to give something, or we owed something.
Yeah, yeah. I think some were more along the lines of, and there'd be as many differences as there were let schemes, but yeah, I could see sort of some sort of worth or socialistic value where people are just exchanging oh, I'm a painter, I'll give you 2 hours of my labour if you come and do 2 hours of my garden. But the schemes, I think, as they became generalised, were about
selfish for themselves,
exchanging tokens, and then you're getting into the realms of more of a labour voucher idea, and trying to build on that. Some idealists were trying to build on that to create, to extend it. But I don't think that was generalised. Don't think it got very far.
Richard and then Vince.
Yeah, just very, very briefly, just one observation about those schemes. I did a little bit of research into them some years ago. A great number of LEC schemes operated with local currency. So that although some actually were trading labour, on other occasions, you would actually define what your labour was worth in terms of the local currency, and you would actually. So there were various kind of, you know, various types of ways of doing this. But one very interesting development which occurred in a number of schemes around the country, and principally in Milton Keynes, which I looked into, was that they started out in the normal way of bookkeeping and having their local currency and deciding how much anybody has paid in and how much they got out. And they got fed up with it. And in the end, they just started doing things for one another. So, you know, if that's the direction in which it takes, I'm all for it.
Vince?
Very clearly, the means of communication have expanded enormously since the days of the foundation of the Socialist Party in the beginning almost of the 20th century. And so if socialism had really been a possibility, say, of 1910 or somewhere like that, in those days, it would have been very difficult to establish free access to goods and services because, although capitalism was already fairly highly developed by the 20th century, that development was very uneven in one part of the world compared with another part of the world. Now, fast forward to the situation now, the problem of getting socialist ideas across to people is, as we I know only too well, it's still very difficult, but the means are there to communicate those ideas to people very quickly. And when a significant number of people begin to realise that there is a genuine alternative to socialism, then by means of the internet, one form or other, those ideas will be communicated very quickly. Now, the point that I'd like Colin to deal with is, if that does happen at some time in the not-too-distant future, and those ideas are being established globally, the ideas of an alternative to capitalism. My concern is not that ultimately, once a socialism has been established, will there be enough goods and services to supply people with what they both want and need, whether there would be any type of restraining period in certain parts of the world, even now, which we must admit are considerably undeveloped compared with North America, parts of East Asia and Europe. Would there be any need for a restraining period in which those labour vouchers might be necessary, even though it might be only for a short period?
I would argue not. I mean, the practical effort, I mean, if you're talking about continents like Africa, where you know, underdeveloped continents, parts of the world, the emphasis would be on increasing production, on restoring agriculture, doing away with monoculture, raising productivity of land. Why would you need to go back to some sort of measurement of exchange of labour, but you know, is there parts of the world where people can't work? You know, there's nothing to work. The emphasis will be on development of the means of production in those places. I can see no reason why you would require labour vouchers. And I would envisage in that scenario that if it was global, that if there was shortage of foodstuffs and shelter in those places, it would be a reasonably easy enough thing to move it there. And I personally can't see the scenario where you would use them. As I say, I think we ought to look less at how we're going to move goods around, and more on how we're going to change production. Because in places that are at the moment undeveloped, we'll be able to develop themselves. And places such as China exporting iPods and whatever else around the world, or the US importing vast quantities of stuff, I mean, that would probably cease. You might have movements of raw materials around the world, but would you really have the situation as we have today, of the vast waste involved in the sort of globalised, unequal development in the global economy? I don't think so. I think particularly in terms of agriculture, where if you were to have a couple of acres out here, post-socialism, well, let's just take it today. If you wanted to make to use that field, and capitalism, you have to make money at it. The only way you can make money at it is by planting one crop across that entire field and trying to sell it at the best price you could get. Now, post-capitalism, what you would try and do, I would imagine, would be one, to perhaps grow as much as you possibly could on there, which would be growing lots of different crops on there, lots of different types of crops. And, perhaps you would have... Well, how do we, have an ecological twist to that? How do we maximise the amount of wildlife that's in here as well as what we did? So the questions that you would ask yourself would be utterly different. It wouldn't just be a case of how do we, exchange what we've got, but what are we going to produce tomorrow? How are we going to do it differently?
Could it be done, just one other point, could it be done, I know this is looking at it in a fairly extreme way, but could that transformation take place almost overnight, straight away?
I absolutely believe it could, because if that idea carries itself through to actuality, then it would. How could it not? I don't understand how it couldn't, because you would have a majority of people wanting it to work, consciously wanting it to work, taking production for the first time in human history into our hands, producing stuff for its own ends, for our own ends. We're deciding what we produce. It's as much about that as it is about what we're going to do with all the stuff that we've got. It's moving the debate on. It's moving the question on a hell of a lot from that to are we going to turn up for work tomorrow? What else are we going to do? And it's got all sorts of problems. But if a majority of people carry through a revolution to bring that into, how? Is distribution really going to be an issue? I don't think so.
Dougie and then Dan.
Yeah, just talking about world as we have at the moment, there's maybe a billion people living in shanty towns, and there's going to be major health problems, and there's major problems about malnutrition in the world, with people not having clean water, and there'd be an immense amount of work needed at the start to sort things out, really. Yeah, I mean, people don't want to live in shanty towns, really.
Yeah,
you've got maybe, I don't know, it's about that billion people in the world living in shanty towns. There's going to be massive things to sort out, and I think, whether we have an iPod or a laptop or whatever, by the board, people will be sorting out basic problems in the world, I think, you've got to deal with the shanty towns and the lack of water and the lack of medical supplies and the lack of food, right? And you mentioned about cash crops. People grow flowers and bring them over here from Africa or whatever and sell them, the cash crops. Sometimes people starve because, they don't have access to the land or whatever, And then you've got all the wars that are going on at the moment, in capitalism. That will have to be stopped and things.
So at the start, there's going to be major problems right here.
Yeah. But for the first time, we'll actually have control of the means of production.
Yeah, well,
and the point is, we can start looking at use values, how to solve those problems with stuff, rather than how we're going to, you know, what means of exchange, what we might we go back to.
Just a quick point. I'm hoping Janet's taking a lot of this in because, the questions and suggestions about how a sort of a post-capitalist moneyless society could work has, you know, been the subject of Janet's talk on Sunday morning. So, you know, keep some questions and thoughts in your head for then as well. Although hopefully it's all good grist to the mill, Janet.
Excellent.
Okay, Dan?
Okay, I would like to say that on my views on labour vouchers are extremely divisive between people who are able to contribute labour and those who can't, which basically chucks each according to me under the bus.
Don't follow that.
Yeah. Do you want to sort of expand on it a bit more?
I feel that it depends on how labour is contributing, but what if someone's ill, cannot gain these labour vouchers?
Yeah.
Well,
that was Marx's criticism of it.
Would you finish, Dan? Or?
Sorry.
Yeah. Basically, if people can't gain these labour vouchers, you're essentially creating a two-tier system
already.
People who are able to gain them, people who can't, and resources should be given to those in most dire need first, rather than those who have earned it by working.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. Marx goes into that and sort of says, you know, you're not going to have direct exchange anyway, because you're going to have to take, this is only, your only labour voucher entitles you to a portion of what's left over after the sick and you know, and the elderly who can't work, you know, get their portion. So it's only going to be that portion of that part of the population that is fit to work that would have labour vouchers anyway. Everyone else would be taken care of. So it's sort of, you know, labour vouchers are exchanging what's left over after hospitals, schools and everything else have sort of had their share. But, you know, he does go on to say that, you know, one person works harder than another. And do I get twice as many, you know, labour vouchers as you, because I work twice as hard in that hour's labour. So it takes no account of that. And that's why he sort of referred to it as a sort of, you know, right to inequality rather than equality. So, yeah.
Any other points, Danny?
I've got this kind of idea. I can't see it. It's like a revolutionary triangle. You know, like fire. You've got to have like fuel, oxygen, and heat. We're a revolution. First off, you've got to have production, and you know we've got that in Spain. And then we need communication. We've now got that. You know, with speed of light. And what we haven't got, brings the triangle together, is consciousness, understanding. You know, of how we live, how we might live, and above all, who we are. And then once we've figured all that out, then we'll just be human beings and be free human beings, because that would be the thing, to be free. And all the time, you know, you there's kind of like there's a price system going on. Anything with a price can't be free. And we want to be rid of all that. We want to bring freely of our social creativity and then take freely, you know, from our own self-determined needs from social production. And without a society like that, we just cannot be free.
Any other points? Adam?
Yeah. So, Danny's just brought out why labour vouchers is a crackpot idea, because we've just been talking about the entitlement of people in return for work. You'd also have to have a price of everything in exchange. So you do the whole thing all over again. You have a huge bureaucracy trying to work out what an individual's contribution was. Another huge bureaucracy trying to work out what the labour time value of everything which people consume is. It's a mad idea. One ex-comrade said it's a pity that the critic of the Gotthard programme survived. It's a pity it just didn't appear. You know, Engels burnt it as soon as he received it. Because all the other writings of Marx on labour money, like you said, they're saying it's a nutty idea. It won't work. You can't work. You know, it's the last thing we would try in a socialist society if there was any shortage of anything. It's incoherent. As somebody else just pointed out there, and Danny just pointed out, it's It's a pity we have to. We're lumbered with the idea somehow.
I think, if you finished.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. It's just when you read the whole thing through, I mean, it really is a response to ideas of equal exchange and getting the access to the whole product of your labour. It's a response that Marx is saying, well, if you really want that, this is what it would look like in the context of a post-capitalist society. But that's not really what we're after. You know, it may be that it be necessary, but that, you know, that's what it would look like. If all the people at Ferdinand de Sal wanted that, that's what it would look like. But it would be a stopgap, and you know, it's not what we're really after. That's not the point of what we're doing. And I think people have obviously, you know, taken those comments and run with them in the light of what Lenin goes on to say afterwards. But yeah, I think when you read the whole of the critique of the Goethe poem, it doesn't come across as someone which is advocating labour vouchers. It comes across as a criticism of their narrowness and their usefulness. So I don't think, you know, the ideas that Marx supported them, I think he comes across as a little bit equivocal in that work, but no more than that.
Bill?
Well, I think there's a section in it's in Capital 2, where it says, we could use labour vouchers. I mean, the phrase is as bland as that.
Yeah.
The key part of the section is he says it's when we have a conscious association, that's the key thing.
Yeah.
And then we could use labour vouchers if we need to. But on that, I mean, that's something that's come up in the course of this. You've talked about a majority wanting socialism, but of course we're going to have to get the minority to buy in. As we've just seen with the EU referendum, there's been a clear vote by a majority that's not evenly distributed across the country for one thing, and there's a very, very pissed off minority now who are doing their damnedest to frustrate that majority democratic decision and try to prevent the UK leaving the EU if they can. So, you know, gaining the majority isn't necessarily going to win over that small minority. And likewise, I think it's the cyberneticist Paul Cockshott. He advocates labour-time vouchers as an educational tool. The idea is that we can make clear this conscious association between that our share of labour and our products. And when you're dealing with perhaps some bits of the world where literacy hasn't yet spread, where there is still peasantry, where there is, it could well be a way into bringing people within the world socialist movement as it would be developing. So I don't think we can necessarily rule them out.
Yeah, I mean, and you can't do these debates all night, can we? But I mean, what might be? I mean, I can't sit here and say we would definitely never would be used. And some of the scenarios you suggest, you know, a fair point. But you know, I just cannot conceive of a situation of post-capitalism where we would go back, as Adam says, to assist. Who would want to volunteer to put that bureaucracy together? Not the people that wanted the revolution, definitely not the people who were opposed to it. You know, yeah. So I just cannot. So I can't for life me see why we would want to do it. That said, if we did, we would.
Rob, and then
to accommodate what you referred to, we're lumbered with the idea of labour vouchers. I think we're lumbered with bourgeois attitudes that the working class will not be capable of organising tight and rational basis once we get control. The only argument I've heard as espousing for labour values is that there's going to be a continued scarcity. Well, if that happens when the revolution comes, then what will we do is rationally look and see what resources are needed where, just distribute them in the most sensible way so the people who need them as quickly and effectively as possible, and at the same time start to organise production to be increased where it needs to be increased in order to meet immediate needs. And these will be, when this revolution is going to come out of nowhere, people are going to be discussing these issues for probably tens of years until the day comes. So, you know, I can't believe we're going to be in a position where we're going to have to worry about issuing bits of paper to get back things that we really value. And,
Yeah, I mean, the socialist idea is essentially to move from exchange values to use values, and the idea that that once we'd accomplished, a socialist society that you would want in any way to move back to any ideas of exchange. I agree with you, Rob. I can't see that happening. But actually, I think Comrade Martin sort of say, practically in. As things really happen, can we ever sort of rule out that we might use something like it or similar? We can't stand here and sort of say, no, we definitely wouldn't. Well, what we're saying is we envisage that we wouldn't. That's all we can say. We can't say what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. But if the point of the idea is to move from exchange values to use values, I can't see it. I can't see why we would.
Even today in this horrible society, there's a huge desire for human beings to help each other. You get these natural disasters, and then people, put the money in their pockets to give to charities to help these people, irrespective of whether they will actually help them. But those people are not going to sit there and think, oh, I'll give a fiver as long as it goes to someone who's actually working the last month. People are not going to. Do you think people are
going to
think like that in a
post-private
ownership society?
Richard?
Yes, a number of comrades talked about huge bureaucracy. Well, unfortunately, as a wage slave, I'm a slave of the state, and what I do is a terrific waste of time, but I've got to feed myself. And I work on economic statistics, along with others, many other thousands of board slaves around the world. And what they're doing, what we have to do, we have to basically measure all this activity that goes on in our country and all these other countries. And we have to, the only way we can measure it in capitalist society is by putting a price on it. It always has to be expressed in money. And it's a completely absurd approach. We have all this information about what's produced, who's producing it, and where. And all we're interested in is coming up with these figures, GDP, which have no basis in reality. So I look forward to the day when the socialist revolution comes, which we'll take part in, probably that long. We can scrap all this. We'll still collect the information. As Vince was talking about, we have amazing ability to communicate. We don't need to use money or labour vouchers or anything else to communicate, to match supply with demand. And even more to the point, at a local level, in the socialist society, people will be able to make their own decisions on what needs to be done. Just as Colin was saying about what we grow in the field out there. So I'm looking forward to not having to do this anymore, and possibly I'll get on a free aeroplane flight to Africa and dig a well instead.
James, and then Vince.
There's another thing that comes out of this than that. Adam said it'd be a huge bureaucracy and it'd be extremely difficult to organise a labour time voucher system. But also there's going to need to be some kind of regulation, and there's going to need to be some kind of policing of it. Because you're excluding people from the means of production, from the means of life, unless they have a piece of paper or token or whatever it is. Now, what do you do with socialist-minded people who say, I'm going to take that because I want socialism. I'm taking it. I do my fair share, but, I want that, and I don't have a labour time voucher for that particular thing at the moment. I'm taking it. Are you now going to start bringing back the police? Are you going to bring back security guards? Are you going to have a state to oversee the whole system? This is the kind of road you're going to go down.
Yeah. Which is
back to square one.
Yeah. Good point.
Vince?
Although I was suggesting earlier on that there might possibly be a short period when socialism is being established when there will quite likely be some problems of reallocation of goods and services because of the different levels of development in the world, not just now, but probably in the future. I think a positive aspect of this is the power of voluntary labour. Now, I can remember, and big people still argue this, as we know only too well, that the object to socialism will talk about the selfishness of human nature, in inverted commas, or human behaviour, or something like that. And their ideas to the gullible might have appeared quite credible about 30 or 40 years ago, but if we look at what's happened in modern society just over the last 30 or 40 years, in this society where we need money in order to live, and there is so much greed, particularly by the ruling class, the point is that the majority of the population, many of them are involved in voluntary work. So if people can give a lot of their time doing voluntary work in capitalist society, where they're not gaining that much from that voluntary work, just imagine what the enormous incentive there will be for people to do voluntary work, when they are collectively gaining huge amounts.
Bill and then Danny. Or did you want to come back on it?
Well, I think, I mean, some people, it's a bit interesting about the fact that there's transitional periods, particularly Richard over there, about, you know, people doing currently useless work, going on to do useful work. But there'll be this massive dislocation as these hundreds of thousands of accountants and financiers suddenly find themselves having to find them do slightly more useful work. And they're going to have some way of communicating and coordinating this shift in the labour process. And I don't think you necessarily would need a centralised bureaucracy. In fact, there's things like the website Splitit, with two Ds, for people to, or, you know, you just use the mobile phone to allocate tasks among themselves and to allocate numbers of hours according to people's, you know, expressed preferences in types of work. But the very idea that it's about partially alienating people from the means of life, well, yes, it is going to be about telling the Duke of Westminster he's going to go off to get himself a job. And Richard Branson and all these other people who don't have to work at the moment, who are going to have to learn to work. So that's kind of part of the idea, is that part of this transition from how we're going at the moment to a society where there will be a significant, substantial minority who may need to be given a bit of a helping hand to join in with what we have democratically agreed to divide our labour among across the world.
Danny?
I mean, just quickly answer Bill's point, when it comes to Richard Branson and his Sodom, you know, they can make their own arrangements. I mean, they're just not be able to push anybody around anymore. But, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking Bill here is just using his encyclopedic knowledge of Labour time badges to enrich the debate. But I think, because I don't believe him in 1 minute, but I think the people who do advocate Labour time badges have a very kind of monochromatic imagination. And what they do, they take the psychology human beings have in capitalism and they transpose it into socialism. See, the thing is, and I mean, it's commonwealth, I should imagine, with if not everybody, but most people in this room, is the reason why we are socialists is that we have all had an individual revolution in ourselves. We've had a revolution in the way we think, in the way we see ourselves, the way we see the world, the way we want to live. And when the revolution finds its completion, it will be because the vast majority of people have done exactly the same thing. If we've done it, they can do it.
And the result of that, those masses of people having that individual revolution, will be a social revolution. And then once we've got that, you know, we'll make our own arrangements. And as I said earlier on, the first thing we've got to do after a revolution is, one, make sure everybody's up on their feet and out of poverty. And the second thing is clean up the mess capitalism's left us to deal with. That's what's going to fire us up. And of course, socialism will be a society that's come of age, that's completed its historical rite of passage. And what adults do when an adult comes of age, they know who they are, they know what they want and how to get it, and they also get a qualification, and that is they're qualified to take responsibility for children, to actually secure the future. And a socialist society will be doing that, trying to secure the future. So therefore, yeah, that's what we'll do. We'll make sure everybody's future is secured by looking after people, so people can look after themselves. We're not going to patronise people. I'm just cleaning up the mess.
Brian, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I'd just like to ask a simple question, actually. You mentioned Paragon. Can you just give us your reflections on this participatory economics? Because it's very popular in some quarters.
Yeah.
Although I must admit, I can't understand, Albert's books. It's so full of detail, I can't sort of get my head around it.
Very, very far from an expert on the Paragon or Zeitgeist.
Got one in the audience.
Okay. All right. Really, my criticism would go towards the idea, and I think that in all of those sort of ideas, that you have something that operates in parallel to capitalism and that it works better than capitalism, that people prefer it, and by its influence it starts to change capitalism into something else. And in that sense, they're not really that different to Robert Owen's ideas of setting up communities within capitalism and gradually expanding until it becomes one giant community that is different from what went before. And in practice, what happens is that if you've got commodity exchange still carrying on, i.e. if you don't have a moment in time when the means of production become the common property of everybody, as opposed to of some of us, that if you've still got that commodity production and exchange going on, money is a far better way of exchanging that. And what happens is the parallel economies drop off and capitalism carries on as normal. And I think, there isn't an example of it working. I mean, there's lots of cases put for the educational value of these things. You would have thought it would have made more headway by now. That would be my question.
Oh, sorry, Dougie, someone jumped in before you. James, and then Dougie.
I was wondering about Bill's point here that laying the time vouchers would help the transition from people doing, work, to the capitalist class, or socially useless work, in terms of like the city of London or something, to useful work. I'm just thinking that labour time vouchers might be the thing that actually stops that happening. Because if you're working in some office somewhere, and you get labour time vouchers for the amount of time that you work, you better keep there, haven't you? You better stay there and get your labour time vouchers, because that's what you need to go and get your bread and your beer, Giving that up, now you're in a bit of a position of insecurity now until you find something else. Yeah? So it's just possible that the back actually might not do what you say, it might do the reverse.
Dougie?
Yeah, just a point. Didn't Marx say the workers themselves can't buy out the capitalist class, really? Yeah, because they don't have the wealth to do it, then. In terms of kibbutzes.
Oh yeah, and cooperatives.
All these kind of things. What they did in Spain and things like that. And as long as you've got commodity production and private ownership or whatever, you're not going to be able to transform that by workers putting the pennies together and trying to make money that way.
I think in practice what actually happens is instead of the sort of influence spreading from the cooperative outwards and gradually sort of introducing it goes the opposite way, that cooperative enterprises become ever more capitalistic.
I'd like to sort of start to wind the discussion up. Obviously we can sort of take some more points, but seems it's getting off a quarter past nine. But Adam?
Yeah, I think Danny's put his finger on it again. The idea behind these schemes, Paracon, Labour Time Vouchers, even Andrew Clyman, is that if people won't work unless they're forced to work. So they want to economically force people to work because they don't think they would otherwise. I mean, I think that's behind all these schemes. And it's a mistaken view of what human behavior is. People will work, or could work, without being forced to, but they think they won't, and therefore they have to be obliged to work by going and getting labour time vouchers or whatever paradigm it was. That's the thing.
Any other points at all? Oh, Danny?
Just a quick one. A few years ago when I was in work, there was a crowd of us builders who were really friendly, and whenever we needed something done on our house, we'd call on one another. And I can remember on one occasion going around wanted a floor laid in the garage, which was for three of us was a real good day's work. And we just got stuck in, my friend's wife would bring us out tea and biscuits and we got stuck. And it was a really great day. And when we finished, it was the approbation. I laid the floor and they did the labouring. The approbation was worth more than money. And the same thing when I needed stuff done, is you get a couple of friends that come around and get stuck in and help you out. And we'd have a really good time doing it. We went to work, we were doing it for months, didn't really enjoy it, we were just going through the motions. So I think that'll be it. What did William Morrison said? He said a volunteer was worth 10 pressed men. Work will become enjoyable. It will be, one of life's prime wants, actually be useful, to be creative. As I said earlier on, we won't be capitalist man in socialism. We'll be human beings doing what human beings do.
Any other points? Sure. Okay. Thanks very much for an interesting discussion, and catch up with you soon.
Thank you.